somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech by Jakob Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 35, White Man's Burden, Empire, Liberalism, and Censorship. What you just heard were protesters in Hong Kong singing the British national anthem, God Save the Queen, while waving Union Jack flags at mass pro-democracy protests that have rocked Hong Kong since June 2019. Millions have taken to the streets to protest an extradition bill that would allow Hong Kong citizens to be prosecuted in mainland China. The use of the British national flag and anthem is a clear rejection of the authoritarian political system of mainland China in favor of the political system inherited from the British based on the rule of law, including freedom of the press. The symbolic value would not be lost on Britain's imperial masterminds and administrators, many of whom thought that empire and liberalism went hand in hand. In a combination of genuine goodwill and blatant ethnocentrism, the British colonizers took on the burden of civilizing the world. In the words of the Whig politician Thomas Macaulay, the aim was to create a class of natives, English in taste, in opinions, in morals and intellect, an imperishable empire of our arts and our morals, our literature and our laws.
And as we've seen, those laws had by now come to include a robust protection of freedom of the press.
In 1885, the great English jurist A.V. Dicey wrote,
"The press, and especially the newspaper press, has practically enjoyed with us a freedom which till recent years was unknown in continental states. This contrast is not only striking in itself, but also affords the strongest illustration that can be found of English conceptions of the rule of law."
And this happy state of affairs was not confined to the British Isles. Halsbury's Law of England declared boldly, "In the British colonies, the press is as free as it is in England." Seen in that light, who could possibly be against Britain's civilizing mission of spreading liberal ideas and freedom of speech to the greatest empire in the history of mankind? With British values and the rule of law, the sun would never set on press freedom. Only the actual practice of British colonialism was very different from the idealized version dreamt up by English liberal imperialists and modern Hong Kong protesters. As we'll see, the British colonial masters were more than willing to use censorship and repression when news and ideas were thought to threaten British interests in places like Hong Kong, India, and Africa. The laws and practices not only stifled the merest whiff of dissent, but also did so on the basis of crude racial and ethnic prejudices. This created a parallel system of censorship and repression that severely undermined the liberal credentials of Britain. And as we shall see, the wobbly British legacy still shapes the climate for free speech in some former colonies. Much the same schizophrenia characterized France's colonial empire, supposedly built on its commitment to universal human rights, stretching back to the Declaration of the Rights of Man.
A commitment that became difficult to sustain when the colonized insisted that freedom and imperialism were incompatible.
India was the crown jewel of Britain's colonial empire, with its abundant natural resources, huge size, and massive population. In 1858, the British took direct control of the Indian subcontinent, which until then had been run, some would say ruthlessly exploited, by the East India Company, whose huge private armies had subjugated most of the subcontinent in previous centuries. None other than John Stuart Mill was a longtime employee of the East India Company. And Mill believed it was Britain's burden to civilize the world. peoples like the Indians and the lower rungs on the ladder of civilization needed the dominion of foreigners to carry them up the ladder and clear away obstacles to improvement. But Britain's leading strings were only admissible as a means of gradually training the people to walk alone. As we've seen, Mill was an unconditional proponent of free speech, at least in the civilized world. In India, Mill's attitude was more like, yeah, whatever. He thought that both the dangers and the advantages of the free press in India have been very much overrated. He added, "From the little knowledge I have of the Indian newspaper press, I should say that its comments are seldom of any value." And at any rate, Indians were too subjugated by centuries of despotism and primitive custom to make much use of individual rights. But that might change with a little help from their British friends. In other words, press freedom in India was not really a matter of much concern to the greatest champion of press freedom in the 19th century. Pretty telling. But the philologist and missionary James Long did think free speech essential to Britain's civilizing mission. Books had the ability to break down ignorant prejudices among the old school of Hindus. But Long also had ulterior motives. If the British studied Indian literature, they could detect rebellious signs before it was too late. In 1857, Long made a comprehensive survey of Bengali literature. The total output of works until 1820 was as little as 30 titles. But by 1857, Calcutta alone had 46 printing presses churning out 322 new works in 12 months, including 6 newspapers and 12 periodicals. In 1860, a few years after a rebellion by Indian troops, the Indian Penal Code was adopted. It codified British anxieties and was riddled with offences like unlawful assembly, wanton provocation, public nuisance, obscenity, disturbing a religious assembly, and wounding religious feelings. All to keep the social peace among the restless natives who needed the steady hand of a British authority to ensure communal tranquility. Ironically, one of the first victims was none other than James Long.
He had published an English version of a Bengali play that heavily criticized how English planters exploited poor peasants. For setting race against race, Long was fined and sentenced to a month in prison.
In 1870, the Indian Penal Code was expanded to cover, you guessed it, the crime of seditious libel, defined loosely as anyone who excites or attempts to excite feelings of disaffection to the government. But despite the plethora of speech crimes in the Indian Penal Code, the British initially took a hands-off approach to policing content and opted for Long's policy of literary surveillance. Under a Press Act of 1867, publishers were required to send copies of books printed and provide information like title, author, subject, and publisher. Failure to comply was punished with a fine and imprisonment for up to 2 years. The resulting catalogues from 1868 to 1905 cover some 200,000 titles. And at the turn of the century, Indian printing presses were churning out over 5,000 books per year. And Indian nationalism and criticism of colonial rule slowly started appearing in print too. This is when the Indian Penal Code came in handy. Bal Gangadhar Tilak was a nationalist leader whose weapon of choice was the pen. He edited a weekly paper called Kesari, which was the highest circulating paper in India. After a period of unrest and protest in June 1897, Tilak wrote an article in which he justified the murder of a general back in 1674 as done for the good as others and in order to drive out oppressive foreigners. A week later, Indian nationalists assassinated a British official. To the furious British, Tilak's veiled and suggestive articles had incited the murder, and he was charged, convicted, and sentenced to 18 months in prison for sedition. Even with Tilak behind bars, the British expanded Section 124 just to be on the safe side. Now, disaffection to the government also included the promotion of disloyalty and all feelings of enmity. And then came the icing on the cake. Section 153A, criminalizing the promotion of feelings of enmity or hatred between different classes of Her Majesty's subjects, an early form of hate speech law. But that did not deter Tilak, who went straight back to Kesari after being released. Tilak and the nationalist movement was radicalized after the partition of Bengal in 1905. Tilak advocated a boycott of British goods and a program of passive resistance, which later inspired Gandhi's policy of non-cooperation. But he also promoted a more active and militant program of resistance. In April 1908, two British women were killed in a terror attack directed at a judge. Tilak condemned this monstrous deed, but added, "Rulers who exercise unrestricted power must always remember that there's also a limit to the patience of humanity." He continued that newspapers had long warned the British that the oppression of Indians would make terrorist attacks inevitable. Bombs had become the last resort for hot-headed young men whose legal avenues of protest and political influence had been cut off. In effect, Tilak was advancing a pressure cooker theory in which the denial of free speech would lead to regrettable but inevitable violence, and that the only remedy was to protect rather than restrict the rights of the people. Safe to say that that was not a theory shared by the British. Tilak was tried for both sedition and promoting enmity between communities. And he was sentenced not only to 6 years in prison, he also had to do his time in faraway Burma. The sentencing judge explained the tough sentence.
"It seems to me that it must be a diseased mind, a most perverted mind, that can think that the articles that you have written are legitimate articles to write in political agitation. They are seething with sedition. They preach violence. They speak of murders with approval."
This judicial rant is a perfect vindication of the long line of thinkers like Montesquieu, who stressed the need to limit restrictions on free speech to words intimately connected with criminal deeds, rather than vague concepts like sedition that can be abused to punish unpopular speech. In India, more political assassinations followed, and Hindu-Muslim violence also exploded. The authorities now saw nationalist publications as an existential threat, according to a British commissioner.
"The gravity of the situation demands that we take whatever is absolutely the most effective measure for controlling sedition in the press, without regard to any Western theories or sentiments which are not applicable to the condition of this country."
Robert Danton writes that this led to a systematic crackdown, including raids on bookshops, interrogation and intimidation of suspects, arrests of authors, publishers and printers, the interception of letters and packages in the mail, even the use of secret agents to report on what was said in meetings and what was read in schools. Increasingly paranoid colonial officials saw sedition everywhere and confiscated works like Aristotle's Politics and an 1838 book that was critical of the East Indian Company. They prosecuted poems, plays and songs, often based on strained and fanciful interpretations of opaque and equivocal wording. In 1908, jury trial was restricted in sedition cases, and in 1910, the Indian Press Act ordered owners of presses to deposit security and empowered officials to confiscate printing presses in case of openly seditious writings and veiled incitement to inculcate hostility to British rule. In 1927, the British even introduced a blasphemy law after a Hindu publisher was killed by a Muslim after insulting the Prophet Muhammad. But despite, or perhaps because of, the crackdown, Indian independence gained a new formidable champion. No one better symbolizes India's anti-colonial struggle for independence than Mahatma Gandhi, whose efforts have become the gold standard for nonviolent resistance to oppression. Dr. Martin Luther King wrote that, "India's Gandhi was the guiding light of our technique of nonviolent social change." Gandhi may have rejected guns, but the principle of free speech was a crucial weapon in his arsenal. Freedom of opinion and freedom of forming associations were the two lungs that are absolutely necessary for a man to breathe the oxygen of liberty. Gandhi also practiced free speech. He started several journals, both when working as a lawyer in South Africa and after returning to India. Shunning violence, Gandhi mobilized the masses through happenings and an effective use of symbols like the Gandhi cap. The spinning wheel or khadi was an especially powerful symbol of Gandhi's nationalist movement, a symbol of rural, traditional and manual India against the cold, technological British. Things once again exploded in 1919, when all public meetings in the Punjab were banned. An unarmed crowd defied the ban, and a Brigadier General Dyer ordered his troops to shoot, killing 379 people and wounding more than 1,000. To the outrage of most Indians, Dyer was exonerated, leading to further disaffection for British rule. After the incident, Gandhi published 3 articles declaring sedition a duty.
Sedition has become the creed of Congress. Non-cooperation deliberately aims at the overthrow of the government and is therefore legally seditious.
In another article, he declared war on the Viceroy, Lord Reading. Lord Reading must understand that non-cooperators are at war with the government. And Lord Reading got the message loud and clear. He promptly ordered the arrest of Gandhi and his publisher for sedition, resulting in what became known as the Great Trial. As a student, Gandhi had intensely studied Plato's Apologia, and he put it to good use. He faced a prosecutor alone to symbolize the unequal relationship between India and Britain. And like Socrates, he did nothing to save himself.
I have no desire whatsoever to conceal from this court the fact that to preach disaffection towards the existing system of government has become almost a passion with me. I do not ask for mercy.
Then Gandhi took aim at section 124A of the Penal Code, which he called
the Prince among the political sections of the Indian Penal Code designed to suppress the liberty of the citizen. Affection cannot be manufactured or regulated by law. If one has no affection for a person or system, one should be free to give the fullest expression to his disaffection, so long as he does not contemplate, promote, or incite to violence.
A formidable defense of free speech, which anticipated current First Amendment standards by several decades. The impressed judge bowed and admitted that Gandhi was a different category of any person I've ever tried or am likely to have to try. Then he sentenced Gandhi to 6 years in prison. Gandhi got up with a smile, thanked the judge for his courtesy and the mild sentence, and walked out the courtroom a martyr. He was released for health concerns after 2 years and continued his nonviolent struggle. Far from suffocating sedition, the Great Trial against Gandhi had provided sedition the most prominent of platforms from which to brutally expose the irreconcilable chasm between British liberalism and imperialism for all to see.
Sadly, the British colonial era laws against sedition, blasphemy, and communal enmity are still on the books in India, where they constitute a threat to authors, filmmakers, and journalists, as we saw in episode 14.
The 1880s kicked off the so-called Scramble for Africa, where European great powers greedily gobbled up African territory. At the end of the scramble, Union Jack was solidly planted across the continent, including in East Africa. Here, economic development was aided by the importation of Indians, who would play a crucial role in the establishment of newspapers, advancing the cause of both Indian and African nationalism. But regulation of publications was relatively light touch. A law from 1906 required Kenyan publishers to register and newspapers to inform the authorities of ownership and annual circulation. The most radical newspapers were the East African Chronicle, edited by M.A. Desai, and The Democrat, printed and edited by Sitaram Acharya. Acharya was once arrested and only just escaped deportation after writing a disparaging editorial on the morals of white women. The East African Chronicle gave a voice to the Kenyan nationalist Harry Tuku, who headed the East African Association and protested colonial policies, not least the deeply racist practice of kipande that forced all African males to carry a registration tag with ID and fingerprints around their necks like a dog tag. The collaboration and cross-fertilization of anti-colonial dissent between Indians and Africans deeply unnerved the British, who saw Indians as agents of communism and puppet masters of gullible Africans who needed the firm but gentle hand of British authority. Even worse, Harry Tuku also contacted prominent black activists in America, like W.E.B. Du Bois of the NAACP and the radical firebrand Marcus Garvey of the Universal Negro Improvement Association. But contact with Garvey, who advocated black nationalism and an apology of Africa for Africans, posed a problem. For Garvey's newspaper, The Negro World, was banned as seditious in many British African colonies, and Tuku therefore became a person of interest to the British. Undeterred, Tuku started the Swahili language newspaper Tangazo, or Attention, in 1921. And with its criticism of white missionaries and appeals to civil disobedience, Tangazo certainly caught the attention of the colonial authorities. In 1922, after a rousing speaking tour where he appealed for united opposition to the British across tribal divides, Tuku and his lieutenants were arrested for jeopardizing public peace and order. Tuku was exiled to 10 years in Somalia. But his arrest caused protest, with more than 20 Africans shot and killed. Others stepped in to fill the void when Tuku had been sidelined. Most prominently, Jomo Kenyatta, who would become the first president of Kenya after independence. Kenyatta edited the Swahili newspaper Mukwitanya, promoting the ideas of the Kikuyu Central Association, which had taken over from the East African Association as the prime African anti-colonial opposition grouping. In 1926, the British governor smelled the influence of radical Indians and feared that there's a danger that this emotional and semi-religious propaganda may spread very rapidly among excitable and ignorant natives. Still, at this point, the British found it counterproductive to initiate a more general crackdown on press freedom, such as had taken place in India. At least for now. For after the Second World War, the British would go full-scale authoritarian to repress the so-called Mau Mau Rebellion. Conditions in British West Africa came closest to the British ideal of extending press freedom to colonial subjects. Already in the 1880s, and much earlier than in East Africa, a free and vibrant press emerged in what is now the Gambia, Sierra Leone, Ghana, and Nigeria. This included independent newspapers critical of British policies and providing a platform for public debate. An editorial in the Gold Coast Echo told readers, "We are positively thirsting for materials that will be talked about at the store, office, a social gathering, or at home." West African newspapers were also keenly aware of the importance of the press as the only medium for the people to express their grievances. When local governors complained to London about the licentiousness of the West African press, their requests for increased censorship powers were rejected. But the 1930s saw a reversal in official tolerance. In 1934, the British Secretary of State distributed a top-secret telegram instructing all British colonial governors to ban the importation of the Negro Anthology. It contained articles by a wide range of authors from around the world, united by the cause of Pan-Africanism and anti-colonialism. The book was edited by Nancy Cunard, who had a solid upper-class background and shocked polite society with her pro-communist views and interracial relationships. This was a cocktail too explosive, even in the permissive environment of West Africa. Even more unnerving was the return of African anti-colonial activists with connections to international anti-imperialist movements who set up radical newspapers. Sedition acts were passed, and authors were put under surveillance and exiled for their writings. Steadily, more foreign publications were put on the index of books prohibited from importation. In the words of one official, "The time has come to take a less lenient line with the press generally." A huge and humiliating about-turn by an empire which for decades had showcased West African press freedom as an example of the blessings of liberal imperialism. In 1842, China was badly outgunned in the First Opium War and had to give up Hong Kong to the victorious British. English language newspapers quickly emerged, but Hong Kong was not a free-for-all Wild East. In the second half of the 19th century, several newspaper editors were prosecuted, fined, and jailed for accusing officials of corruption and favoritism. And soon, the British ideal of press freedom would create new headaches for Hong Kong's government. In the late 19th century, there had been a huge influx of Chinese from mainland China. Naturally, these new citizens wanted news in their own language. But that might very well jeopardize British relations with China, with whom it had already fought two wars over trade access, not least to satisfy the addiction to the revenue from pushing opium. In 1884, four Chinese language newspapers published an imperial Chinese edict calling for armed resistance against the French, who were at war with China. All four newspapers were promptly persecuted. Clamping down on what was written within Hong Kong only took care of internal sources of dissent and instability. So in 1900, all imported publications had to go through the Hong Kong Post, whose job it was to screen for revolutionary or other offensive materials which the governor could blacklist and ban from importation. At the end of the 19th century, the Chinese Qing dynasty was on its last legs and persecuted revolutionaries who fled to Hong Kong and used it as a platform to mobilize public opinion. This was deeply concerning for the British, since they formally supported the Qing dynasty and all the benefits that gunboat diplomacy had accrued. The anti-Chinese publications were, in the words of officials, a serious source of embarrassment. They stressed the need to prevent this colony being made a center for seditious publications. So in 1907, the Chinese Publications Prevention Ordinance was passed. It prohibited the printing, publishing, sale, or distribution of any publication calculated to excite tumult or disorder in China or to excite persons to crime in China. According to law professor Michael Ng, the law was not an empty threat, as numerous, mostly Chinese language newspapers found out. In 1911, the editor of the newspaper Chung Kwok Yat Po was prosecuted for a piece blaming the Qing rulers for famines and wanting to sell the country. It didn't help the editor that an English language newspaper had accused the Qing of being the most incapable, corrupt, decadent, and hopeless race into whose hands have fallen the destinies of any conquered people, without facing any consequences. And this was not the only example of prosecutorial double standards. In the early 19th century, the application of British speech crimes had discriminated on the basis of class. In the early 20th century, they discriminated on the basis of language and race. This parallel system of censorship also applied to the cinema. In 1927, the Secretary of State for the Colonies had circulated a secret memo to all governors stressing the need to censor material that could
arouse undesirable racial feeling by portraying aspects of the life of any section of His Majesty's subjects which, however innocent in themselves, are liable to be misunderstood by communities with other customs and traditions.
By the 1930s, the British Board of Film Censors had listed more than 90 prohibited topics, and newsreels were subjected to censorship at both pre- and post-production, with a third vetting process before export to the colonies. But in Hong Kong, as early as 1919, only films and posters duly censored by the Captain Superintendent of the Police could be exhibited. Censors relied on guidelines by the British Board of Film Censorship. These prohibited depicting antagonistic or strained relations between white men and the colored population of the British Empire. But in Hong Kong, these were expanded to include showing the white man in a degrading or villainous light, imperialistic behavior, that is, armed conflict between the Chinese and the white man, and racial questions, especially the intermarriage of white persons with those of other races. It was also verboten to depict white women in indecorous garb or positions or situations which would tend to discriminate our womenfolk with the Chinese. Bolshevist or mob violence was also a no-no, since the Chinese are easily worked up. In 1928, a local censor expressed the prevailing thought behind the restrictive censorship of cinema in Hong Kong.
Not only are we a small settlement of white men on the fringe of a huge empire of Asiatics, but the chaotic conditions existing owing to the internecine strife of communistic propaganda make it even more necessary to be strict as regards to the matter exhibited.
As we've seen with India and East Africa, Global anti-colonialist and independent movements gained momentum in the early 20th century. So seditious ideas not only threatened alliances with foreign empires, but the British Empire itself. The colonial secretary complained of newspapers of a
highly seditious and disloyal character, and which contained matters which is subversive of all social and economic conditions, and which disseminated among ill-educated persons, are likely to be productive of disturbance and ill-feeling in the colony.
You'll notice how once again calls for censorship is justified by a fear of the lower and ill-educated class. In this case, meaning mostly the Chinese. The very same argument that back home in Blighty had been used to prosecute Paynite ideas in the 1790s and radical reformers and deists like Richard Carlyle in the 1810s and 20s. But while the British government had been forced to err on the side of liberty at home, it would err on the side of order abroad. The adoption of the Seditious Publications Ordinance from 1914 demonstrates perfectly just how differently the always nebulous concept of sedition was interpreted at home and in the colonies.
The definition of sedition included any expression likely or which may have a tendency, directly or indirectly, whether by inference, suggestion, allusion, metaphor, implication, or otherwise, to bring into hatred or contempt the king, government, administration of justice, or any class or section of people.
The ordinance also empowered the governor to ban and seize publications that were deemed seditious. Possession was punishable with up to 2 years in prison, and to top it off, the burden of proof as to whether any incriminating publication fell outside the extremely broad definition of sedition lay on the shoulders of the defendant. But the climate would become even more inhospitable for dissent in Hong Kong. The outbreak of World War I saw the introduction of pre-publication censorship, a break with even the Blackstonian concept of press freedom, which stressed the importance of being able to publish without prior restraints. It is perhaps understandable with limited preventive censorship during wartime. But the topics which newspapers had to submit to preventive censorship were not limited to information that might endanger national security, but included news or information regarding India and Indians wherever situated, the situation between China and Japan, and the revival of monarchy in China. Several newspapers were warned or prosecuted for breaching censorship laws during the war, including the still existing South China Morning Post, which would become an important voice for press freedom. When the war ended, preventive censorship was not decommissioned. In the early 1920s, huge labor strikes rocked the stability of Hong Kong and fed the government's fear of nationalist and communist movements that were mobilizing against imperialist powers. In 1922, the Emergency Regulations Ordinance was adopted. It provided that, on any occasion which the chief executive and council may consider to be an occasion of emergency or public danger, he may make any regulations whatsoever which he may consider desirable in the public interest. These extreme and arbitrary powers included censorship and the control and suppression of publications and communications. In 1925, another strike was used to expand censorship. Any and all printing, publishing, and distribution of Chinese language publications had to be submitted to and vetted by the Secretary of Chinese Affairs prior to publication. In Hong Kong, the clock had been set back to before 1695, when the British Parliament had let the Licensing Act lapse and abolished preventive censorship, but only if you were Chinese. Oh, and the governor could arbitrarily ban the printing and publication of any newspaper for as long as he wished, in which case the police were given powers to confiscate all material needed to operate such illicit publications. At this point, the Brits were doing more to degrade respect for British values than the anti-British writers they feared. The crippling strikes that had precipitated the Emergency Regulations Ordinance ended in 1926. But the ordinance remained on the books. So Chinese language newspapers had to go through the laborious procedure of sending over proofs to the censors who had to approve or delete offensive words or passages. This maze of press laws was used both to prevent and punish material which the British found prejudicial to colonial interests, whether out of geopolitical concerns or fears of nationalist and communist movements. In one case, a newspaper editor and his publisher were prosecuted for advocating a boycott of Japanese goods and businesses due to the Sino-Japanese conflict. The presiding magistrate dismissed concerns about the broad and arbitrary scope of press laws. When it comes to sedition, prevention is obviously better than cure. Both defendants were fined and sentenced to a month behind bars, and the paper had to fold, unable to pay the fine. The South China Morning Post published a critical editorial which savaged the government's spurious claim that censorship was justified due to the potential state of danger. This opens the door to a complete denial of the elementary British right of free speech and must be opposed. Truth be told, the British right of free speech, if such a fundamental right can be said to exist, had long since been gutted in Hong Kong. In 1931, the South China Morning Post once again pointed out the absurdity of justifying existing censorship on a state of emergency that had long since passed.
After 6 years, it may be fairly submitted that the colony has returned to normal. Or are we to live permanently under martial law like any little Chinese village? What of our boasted orderliness and security? What of British freedom, especially the freedom of speech? Censorship of newspapers is always bad. It destroys public confidence in the press and in the government. Since the European papers are not censored, and even the Chinese government at Nanking has recently abolished its censorship, it is time the Chinese papers of the colony were given their freedom.
The campaign to abolish preventive censorship picked up pace in 1936 when 50 editors of Chinese newspapers petitioned a Chinese member of the Legislative Council called Lo Man Kam to champion the cause of press freedom. Lo stepped up and made an eloquent attack on censorship. He demonstrated how, under the cloak of a temporary emergency law, a permanent system of censorship had been imposed upon the Chinese press. He exposed the extreme hypocrisy and double standards of the parallel English and Chinese system of censorship. Several articles on censorship were published in English language newspapers, but censored when translated by Chinese newspapers. When Chinese language newspapers wrote about the censorship debate in the Legislative Council, these pieces were censored too. Low stressed that the Licensing Act had lapsed in 1695. He invoked Blackstone's definition of press freedom and pointed out that Halsbury's laws of England made no colonial exceptions for the liberty of the press. But the Hong Kong government was adamant that the mere potential danger of publications harming trade and relations with friendly powers meant prevention was better than cure. So Low's motion was roundly defeated. But he got the last word.
If you're going to give freedom to the Chinese press only at a time when there's an idealist state, blissful in inertia, and benevolent governments without armaments, then I say to you, sir, don't give it, because there will be nobody in this world to enjoy it.
Preventive censorship continued in Hong Kong until the 1950s. And the Emergency Regulations Ordinance? Well, that's still around. In fact, during the current protests, Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam used it to issue a mask ban during public demonstrations. But the High Court of Hong Kong found the measure in violation of the Basic Law, which protects free speech rights, that went into effect in 1997 when the British surrendered sovereignty over Hong Kong to China. Britain's parting gift to Hong Kong had helped remove the sting in the tail of Britain's own repressive colonial legacy. Britain was not the only major European power struggling with the contradiction of ruling a so-called liberal empire. Across the Channel, Britain's age-old competitor could not afford to be left behind in the struggle for world dominance. So in the last half of the 19th century, France succeeded in establishing a colonial empire second only to the British, with possession of most of West Africa and Southeast Asia, as well as many smaller territories. Under the authoritarian rule of Emperor Louis Napoleon III, there was of course no contradiction at all. Colonial repression mirrored repression at home, only worse. But when France reverted to the republican heritage of the revolution in the 1870s, the problem would become obvious. How could you square the liberal democratic ideals of the Third French Republic with colonial domination? Ideals which had roots stretching back to the Declaration of the Rights of Man from 1789, which held that the free communication of ideas and opinions is one of the most precious of the rights of man. The primary justification for not extending the rights of man to the conquered populations were based on an ideology of systematic racism. Africans and Southeast Asians were categorized as members of inferior races who simply could not handle freedom. Too primitive to be fully autonomous individuals, they could not be given such abstract political rights as the French citizens enjoyed. Again, we see that the arguments that had been used to deny the rights to the European lower classes were now used to deny the rights of colonized non-Europeans. However hypocritical this might have been, it would also be wrong to think that the French liberal ideas were completely ignored in the colonies. The French colonizers took their idea of the colonial project as a mission civilisatrice, or civilizing mission, seriously. The theory was that under the enlightened despotism of France, the so-called inferior races were to be uplifted into civilization with all the rights that came with it. Ernest Roux, the Governor General of West Africa in the early 20th century, hoped to witness
the advancement of the native populations to a higher state of civilization. But such a result cannot merely be decreed. It can only be the end product of a series of patient and converging efforts whose goal is the moral and material improvement of the native. And last, but not least, the guaranteed enjoyment of individual rights and the most sacred right of all, that of individual freedom.
In his rather self-congratulatory image of the almost humanitarian French Empire, Roux explicitly contrasted the French with the British. We cannot proclaim, as have certain powers with monarchist governments, which are not bound by the same doctrines as the French Republic, the theoretical freedom of the natives, only to deny it in practice. And this proclamation was not entirely hot air. In West Africa, the French abolished slavery, weakened feudal institutions, and invested in education. And importantly, they opened a path to citizenship of the most Frenchified parts of the colonial elites. Still, the denial of citizenship to the large majority of colonials and their subsequent lack of rights made them vulnerable to the whims of colonial administrators. Even as they worked to banish slavery, French officials made systematic use of other forms of forced labor. But hey, the intentions were good, as Roux's successor explained. For a long time yet, it will be necessary for our subjects to be brought to progress against their will. One of the most important tools in the supposedly civilizing effort of the French was the printing press, which was seen as essential to the spread of French culture in the colonies. And at least theoretically, the press was supposed to be entirely free. Article 69 of the landmark Press Law of 1881, which we mentioned in the last episode, guaranteed freedom of the press throughout the colonial sphere. When the first West African newspapers popped up, and the worried governor requested the authority to shut them down, his superior remarked, "We must live with the freedom of the press and get used to the slander." In Vietnam, or French Indochina as it was known then, the governor similarly had to accept press freedom. As Albert Serrault, the governor and later prime minister of France, declared, "The Vietnamese receive French culture and we must accept the consequences." But faced with this kind of legal bind, the colonial administrators found more creative ways to control the public sphere. One loophole was to limit the right to publish to French citizens, thus excluding most of the population. But this selective method became ineffective as native elites obtained citizenship and the rest found ways to evade the regulation. A critical French press was bad enough, but the prospect of a truly indigenous press was intolerable. So to evade the regulations of the 1881 press law, all local language newspapers were categorized as foreign press in 1898 and thus made subject to good old-fashioned prior censorship. Much like the British insisted on censoring Chinese language newspapers in Hong Kong. As the supposedly liberal Serrault put it,
"I have always estimated that Indochina must be protected against the effects of a revolutionary propaganda that I have never underestimated by carrying out a double action, one political, the other repressive."
Still, until the beginning of the 20th century, French colonial authorities could easily suppress or just ignore the few voices of colonial dissent. Until 1917, French Indochina only had 3 papers published in Vietnamese, so the censors had an easy time keeping up with the ideas circulated. In fact, the clearest voice of opposition to the authorities in the papers came from French expatriates who protested Sarraut's excessive liberalism. But as the British found out after the First World War, trouble was increasingly brewing, which called for re-evaluating the liberal tendencies of colonial rule. There were several reasons for the growing unrest. The first was the paradoxical but inevitable dynamic of the civilizing mission. As more and more colonials received a modern education and became integrated into the modern economy, they became stronger and better organized to oppose colonial rule. French Empire had been digging its own grave. The second reason was the rise of international anti-colonial thought after the war, both in the liberal form championed by US President Woodrow Wilson and more ominously in the form of communism. The Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917 and the radically anti-colonial message promoted by the Bolshevik regime energized left-wing revolutionaries throughout the world and provided both support and an ideology of colonial resistance. And the newly emerging elites of both West Africa and Vietnam quickly jumped on the revolutionary bandwagon. Colonial administrators looked with horror at the emergence of a radical press in the colonies. In under 2 years following the war, the Vietnamese press had grown from 3 to 7 publications, and more were coming every year. As an observer remarked,
"The multiplication of newspapers aimed at the Vietnamese population has reached outstanding proportions. Not a single week passes without the birth of a new title in either Hanoi or Saigon."
And as the number of newspapers grew, their content became increasingly radical and therefore increasingly subject to censorial redactions. In the 1920s, a new bold and radical opposition paper called New Century began a tactic of direct confrontation with the censorship board by deliberately including subversive articles and publishing the resulting completely blackened out papers. Pamphlets and posters with the censored articles were then distributed afterwards in the streets, with titles such as "How Can We End Our Condition as Slaves?" By 1927, the patience of the administration had run out, and a massive crackdown on the press resulted. Opposition papers were completely shut down, and their journalists arrested and tried for disrupting public security, including most of the staff of the New Century. Mail was regularly intercepted, and even readers of opposition papers were intimidated and threatened with imprisonment. The whole apparatus of censorship and repression that had been banished from France half a century before was now summoned from the dead and unleashed against the Vietnamese, exactly as the British were upping the ante against dissent in their colonies. The opposition, driven by force from the public sphere, now moved underground and laid the foundations for the protracted violent struggles that would kill millions before real independence was finally achieved in 1975. Alas, Vietnamese independence did not free the mouths, pens or presses of the Vietnamese people, as a communist dictatorship was built on the top of the ruins of colonial oppression. And in 2019, the Vietnamese Communist Party is as hostile to free speech as ever, as draconian laws on cybercrime that criminalizes a ridiculously long list of speech crimes and the imprisonment of journalists and bloggers attest. In West Africa, the liberal mask of the French Empire was also dropping by the 1920s due to the panic induced by revolutionary anti-colonial ideologies spreading from Europe. A number of West Africans who had stayed in Paris after fighting in the war became members of the newly formed French Communist Party and published a series of fiercely anti-colonial papers which eventually found their way to the colonies. The writings of African nationalist activists such as the notorious bogeyman Marcus Garvey were also streaming in through Liberia. One West African radicalized in Paris was Louis Hunkanrin from the colony of Daoumi, now Benin. which had developed a strong tradition of free and independent media that it was even allowed to criticize French colonialist policies. Already before the war, Hun Kanrin had written critically of the French colonial regime. When he returned in 1920, he resumed his criticism with a vengeance. But dissenters were on a shorter leash by now, and Hun Kanrin soon found himself behind bars for subversive activities. But since the liberal press regime of Daumi had not been entirely suppressed, Hun Kanrin, like Richard Carlyle and his shopmen, kept firing paper bullets from his prison cell. He launched a campaign of criticism against the governor and established a local branch of the League of Human Rights in Daumi. Hun Kanrin's incessant criticism and activism earned him the nickname the Bolshevik of Daumi, which was not a term of endearment among the exasperated colonial officials at the time. A couple of years later, the colonial authorities had had enough of the troubles caused by the actions and propaganda of a certain press with subversive tendencies and which is making every effort to implant the revolutionary virus in the most evolved milieu, as the Governor General remarked. Out of the same office in Dakar, where his predecessor had proclaimed individual freedom to be the most sacred right of all, now came a series of petitions to the French government requesting permission to curtail that very freedom. And this time, the government happily conceded. The colonial administration were given draconian powers to suppress any publication in any language deemed defamatory or prejudicial to French authority, which sounds almost like the sweeping laws against calumniating the nation during the terror. Surveillance was also ramped up, and all mail coming into the colony was censored for subversive materials in direct violation of the French Penal Code, which guaranteed the inviolability of correspondence. Hun Kanrin, who in his latest move had been implicated in sparking a tax revolt while still in prison, was exiled to 10 years' imprisonment in the Mauritanian desert. And this was no light punishment. None of the four other persons exiled with Hun Kanrin returned alive from Mauritania, which was known as La Guillotine Sèche, or the Dry Guillotine.
It should not surprise us that British and French colonialism failed to reconcile the liberal ideal of free speech with maintaining an empire. But the history of colonial censorship and suppression is not only a warning against the inherent oppression of imperialism. The trial of Gandhi, the censorship of the Chinese language press in Hong Kong, and the enforced exile of African nationalists speak directly to current controversies over the role and consequences of free speech. According to many modern critics, free speech has been weaponized to serve and defend the powerful and privileged at the expense of the poor and marginalized. Take the British academic Anthony Leaker, who claims that free speech is part of an onslaught against a range of oppressed minorities and progressive gains of the last half century, and that the so-called free speech crisis is a self-serving myth manufactured or at least capitalized on not only by racist but predominantly white male centrists seeking to preserve a dominant worldview that normalizes and universalizes the values of their gender, race, and class. But as we've seen, the reality is almost the exact opposite. When oppressed peoples of color in European colonial empires demanded self-determination and equality, free speech was their weapon of choice, and censorship, often along racial lines, the response of their white colonial masters. Far from entrenching existing power structures, champions of anti-colonialism like Gandhi saw clearly that free speech is a principle that equalizes, empowers, and liberates the oppressed while exposing and disarming the powerful.
Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj, and Lars-Emil Nyborg Nissen and Mathias Meyer assisted with essential research.